Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Another transgression of divine law today. Three guests in three segments. Trita Parsi will explain what Israel is up to, trying to draw Iran's Hezbollah into its mad war. Natasha Leonard will talk about the rights appropriation of leftish safe space discourse to shield Israel and its supporters from criticism on campuses. And Stefan Yang will explore the structure of shipping that helped produce the bridge disaster in Baltimore. Israel has launched provocative attacks against Iran in Syria and Hezbollah in Lebanon that look like escalations from its already high baseline level of bellicosity. Why? It seems insanely dangerous. Here are some thoughts as Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and an expert on Middle East politics. He was born in Iran, but his family moved to Sweden to escape political repression. His father had the distinction of being jailed by both the Shah and the Ayatollah. He's got several books to his name, most recently Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy, published in 2017 by Yale University Press. Trita Parsi. Israel's attack in Damascus the other day that killed several top Iranian military figures at its embassy was the latest iteration of an old conflict. They've been doing these assassinations for some time now. They've also been attacking Syrian soldiers. They killed, 36 of them the other day? This looks like a serious escalation. What do you think Israel is up to here? Don't they already have their hands full?
It certainly is a serious escalation because this is targeting diplomatic premises, which is illegal under international law. Not that international law in any way, shape, or form has been inhibiting Israeli actions thus far. But it is an escalation because now the Israelis have hit Iran on Iranian soil, which is different from when they were hitting Iranian IRGC officials, et cetera, on foreign soil. Why is Israel doing this? Well, I think it's quite clear. The administration acknowledges that the Israelis under Netanyahu actually want to enlarge the war. They want to go into Lebanon. They want to have a larger confrontation with Iran for many different reasons. First of all, Netanyahu has always wanted it. He's been pushing the United States to go to war with Iran for 20 years. He's failed. But this may be his best shot yet, because Biden has shown that he has no red lines for Israel, whereas previous presidents put a red line when he came to war with Iran. And he may be now trying to achieve his long-term objective with an American president that so far has shown himself completely unwilling to say no to the Israelis. And also, we should keep in mind that Netanyahu in particular benefits from the war enlarging and prolonging, because he otherwise will be facing charges in court for corruption, and he will very likely land in jail. So in Israel itself, it's widely acknowledged that Netanyahu has no interest in stopping this war. He also has no interest in getting the hostages out, because getting the hostages out takes away a very significant pretext for continuing the war, and he wants to continue the war.
Why? What's the point? It seems like Iran is a pretty big fish to take on.
It certainly is a big fish, but I think the Israeli calculation has been it's much better to take on that big fish before it has further expanded its network of allied organizations and militias in the region and potentially even managed to get to the brink of a nuclear weapon. And this is part of the reason why the Israelis have been pushing for the U.S. to take on Iran for the last 20 or so years. They feel that time is not on their side. Part of the reason why the Iranians have not responded to the many, many attacks that the Israelis have done is for the very same reason, that they believe that time is on their side. They're going to play the long game, absorb a lot of these hits, instead of getting dragged into a war which would be fought on Israel's terms rather than on Iran's terms.
An Israeli journalist friend of mine said at the beginning of this war that Netanyahu's goal was to draw Iran in and then ultimately the U.S. I was skeptical at first, but you seem to agree with that analysis.
I was skeptical at during the first couple of weeks of this war, in which I didn't think that the Israelis were ready for any war at all. And as a result, they certainly weren't ready for an enlarging of the war. The administration line, the Biden administration, says that the Israelis actually wanted to go into Lebanon early on, right away, and that it was the U.S. that prevented them from doing so. I'm not so sure if that narrative is entirely correct, but at least it seems to be an acknowledgement by the administration that the Israelis have, from the very outset of this conflict, wanted to enlarge it.
And what about the Lebanon angle? They're doing some pretty heavy attacks there. What are they trying to do with that?
Same thing over there. I mean, this is the narrative in Israel has turned into one in which they say that it turned out that it was wrong of the Israelis thinking that they could live next to Hamas and thinking that they could contain Hamas in Gaza. And now more than 1,200 Israelis died as a result of that miscalculation. Hezbollah is far more powerful than Hamas. So why should Israel accept living next to Hezbollah? So the demand is that Hezbollah has to essentially move up several miles into Lebanese territory and not be close to the border. Otherwise, it is intolerable for Israel and for Israelis to live so close to Hezbollah. So they have made an ultimatum to the Lebanese that Hezbollah has to withdraw deep into Lebanese territory. Otherwise, Israel will attack. And just last week, the Israeli defense minister said that Israel is going to now embark on a more offensive approach towards Iran and Hezbollah. And it seems like that's exactly what we've seen. These were not miscalculations or mistakes. These were clearly planned out attacks.
So Hezbollah moves back from the border. That effectively becomes a new border. Where does that end?
It wouldn't be a new border in the sense that Lebanese defense forces would still guard the Lebanese border, but Hezbollah's forces would move all the way up to the Litani River.
Hezbollah is really formidable. The last time Israel got in a serious tangle with them, they got their nose very bloodied. Are they up to it now?
By all accounts, Hezbollah is certainly more powerful today and has better technology than it had 2006. But you also have a different situation internally in Israel. In 2006, there was support for the war early on. It very quickly collapsed. And that's part of the reason why the Israeli couldn't continue the war for more than 34 days and had to withdraw and essentially accept defeat. This time around, there's a very different attitude in Israel. Israel has moved far, far to the right. Moreover, the attack by Hamas has also changed the dynamics internally in Israel. And the argument, again, that it's intolerable for Israel to live next to Hezbollah is one that has far more buyers today than it did back in 2006. So the inevitability that there's going to be a war, so it better be a war at our choosing, the timing of it, is an argument that seems to be making, convincing far more people in Israel now than before.
And of course, Biden is essentially giving Israel a blank check, even in expanding the war into these new fronts.
Well, the Biden administration says that they have made it clear that they're not going to accept that they have pushed Israelis, prevented them from going in that direction. And that may well be the case up until now. But bottom line is Biden has also said that he doesn't have any red lines for Israel. The message that says is that Israel can do more or less what it wants and that Biden will follow. And that certainly has been the pattern so far, even when it comes to Rafah. In the beginning, the Biden administration put a very strong red line and said that Israel shouldn't go in. And now they're in negotiations with the Israelis on how to go into Rafah.
And then, Biden will make some noises of disapproval and then promptly send them more bombs and planes. I mean, it's just there's no actions backing up the words. I mean, the words, I guess, were just for domestic U.S. consumption and maybe some international opinion, but there seems to be no force behind any of those words.
None whatsoever. And that's why you actually can't blame the Israelis for doing what they're doing. They have been set an incentive structure by Biden and they're following it, which is there is absolutely no incentives for them to show any restraint. And even when it comes to the international scene, I mean, remember what the Biden administration did last week or earlier this week. They abstained on a veto, allowed a resolution to be passed that demanded a ceasefire, but then immediately turned around and said that the resolution is non-binding, which of course is completely false and erroneous. But nevertheless, they undermine not only their own abstention, but they undermine the very authority of the Security Council and the UN at the same time.
What is behind this unwavering support? Is it Biden personally, a small group around him, a broad consensus among Democratic foreign policy pundits? How do you see that?
No, there isn't a broad consensus among Democratic foreign policy pundits. There certainly is a school that is with Biden on this, but it is an increasingly small school. And even when it comes to being very much in support of Israel, the extent to which Biden has dragged this out, I don't think has that much support, even within the school that is otherwise aligned with Biden on this issue. I personally don't see any strategic valid arguments for what Biden is doing. This really seems to be Biden living in the past, living back in the 1970s when Israel was the underdog, living back in the 1990s in which it was good politics to allow the Israelis to do whatever they wanted to do. These are very different times. First of all, Israel has ceased being an underdog for a very long time. And secondly, if the Biden administration hasn't figured it out by now, probably they never will. This is horrible politics. He is gambling away his own presidency and the chance of a re-election with his support for the Israeli slaughter. And according to him, this election is about the future and the survival of American democracy. And as a result, he's not only gambling away his own presidency, he's also gambling away American democracy, according to himself.
That was Tretta Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute. And now a look at the domestic front. Supporters of Israel have been appropriating leftish language about how protests against the war on Gaza are making them feel unsafe. In her most recent column for The Intercept, Natasha Leonard takes this discourse on. She is a British-born, Brooklyn-based writer who, in addition to her column, is the Associate Director of the Creative Publishing and Critical Journalism Graduate Program at the New School in Manhattan. Natasha Leonard. You opened the piece with a quote from an unnamed Columbia professor who said that geopolitical emojis, that is the Palestinian flag, had evoked trauma reactions, dissociations during Zoom class sessions. I thought it was the left that was made up of snowflakes. What's going on here?
What isn't going on here maybe is a good way to begin. Well, first of all, obviously the right-wing trope of the snowflake left at universities was more correctly only ever applied to a certain strain of liberal frameworks of anti-racist vulnerability sensitivity action. Didn't really ever apply to leftist anti-racism as far as I've seen that kind of organizing, especially in and since 2020. But I suppose, ironically enough, that trope of the snowflake right now, I think, applies most aptly to students and indeed faculty members around the US who are major supporters of Israel and Zionism and are feeling unsafe and express it as such in the face of robust pro-Palestinian and Israel-critical protest on campus, which is happening around the country in great numbers, thank goodness, given the ongoing genocide. And it has now become an issue of personal safety for those who insist on and are perhaps unable to not see criticism of Israel and pro-Palestinian solidarity as a personal threat to them as Jews, a position that we keep repeating is not valid.
Before we go on, you note in the piece that you are Jewish. There has been a remarkable increase in the number of Jews accused of anti-Semitism over the last 6 months, isn't there?
Yes, there certainly has. And not just anti-Semitism in the quite classic trope of self-hating Jew, that if you don't align with Israel, especially, you know, after a decade plus built upon many decades before of really, really vigorous pro-Israel forces and groups, well-funded forces and groups, insisting on the collapsing of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism as categories, even in formal definitions like the IRA definition that's taken up by all too many companies, government bodies, and groups. In the face of that, you also have, thank goodness, a rising number, and there's always been anti-Zionist Jews since prior to the birth of the Nation of Israel, from the Labour Bund onwards up until today, refusing that conflation and saying, no, we are not in our Jewishness represented by and made safe by an ethno-state. And you're seeing that on campuses. And it is very much those students who have been facing, I mean, certainly it's Muslim, Arab and Palestinian students who are facing the worst sort of targeting as anti-Semites for speaking out for Palestine. But you also have groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, active on campus, facing this targeting as anti-Semites or self-hating Jews, for example. At the end of last year, Columbia University banned not only their chapter of student justice in Palestine, but also Jewish Voice for Peace. And we saw this at other universities too, including Brandeis. We saw it in the state of Florida, but perhaps that's not surprising. So yes, it is certainly very much anti-Zionist Jews who are facing this backlash. But I do want to stress that it is Palestinian students who are hurt the most through this.
This is also being folded into Christopher Rufo's campaign against DEI, right?
Yes. So what you're seeing here is very unpleasant constellation, which is a kind of structure of feeling based on a number of forces now, which is certainly top-down right-wing advocacy that we've seen in recent years against DEI, but it's being weaponized in a very specific way, saying people like Christopher Rufo and their non-stop campaigns against anti-racism, by which I mean for racism continuing on campuses and in schools, making the claim that, look, DEI is not serving, they say, Jewish students, I would say Zionist students. So clearly this was always a kind of poison practice, and we can use this moment, and I would say very cynically on the part of those in the Republican Party and like Rufo, to undo these practices in universities, however imperfect we can agree they might be. You also do have Zionist students who I very much believe feel upset, afraid, targeted when they see powerful and loud and even not so loud, for example, you brought up the Palestinian flag emoji, pro-Palestine and anti-Israel protest. I believe that feeling's real. It is all feelings, however viscerally felt, justified just because they're real. Well, no, that's the different question, and that's the problem at hand. I also do believe that white people raised in explicitly racist contexts do feel afraid in the presence of black people on the street. Does that therefore mean they're justified in pulling out a gun and standing their ground? Of course not. This is the result of decades, centuries, upbringings of what I would call no less than indoctrination. If you are brought up like so many of us were, being told that Israel does represent you, Israel is this noble state, this place of safety, and it is yours, without a challenge to that sort of ideological framework, then of course there is going to be a fear response when that entity is demonized and recognized for the really brutal, violent institution that it is. Is it therefore the job of professors and other faculty members and universities and other educational spaces to validate that? I don't think that's what it looks like to take fear seriously and then also think about the material conditions that produce certain fears as legitimate and certain fears as not.
We shouldn't use all this to dismiss reports of a rise in anti-Semitism, though, right? How do we separate the reality from the propaganda here?
I think that's, you know, obviously a crucial point and one I should have made earlier. We are at a moment where it is really, really important to be able to distinguish material threats to safety for Jewish students, for Jewish faculty members, Jewish people, and obviously very profoundly for Palestinian and other Arab and Muslim students. But yes, anti-Semitism in which Jewish people are being targeted, harassed, facing violence, facing graffiti, slurs, genuine threats, because they are Jewish, because they are visibly Jewish or known to be Jewish, that is on the rise. But you have a real problem of reporting here, and I point a finger at groups like the ADL, in that if you have a policy wherein anti-Zionist action is reported and becomes part of data about a dramatic spike in anti-Semitism on campuses and elsewhere, then it actually becomes extremely hard to find out where genuine threats, and we've seen those on the rise very much so since Trump's ascendancy, Jews will not replace us in Charlottesville being the chant. We need to be able to distinguish and point to and vigorously fight against genuine anti-Semitic threat. And obviously when that's diluted amongst false claims of anti-Semitism existing in every act of anti-Zionism, then that doesn't help. It certainly doesn't help me keep myself as a Jew, my comrades, and my Jewish students any safer by allowing this produced feeling to go simply supported and not challenged and worked through to more productive and ethical ends. And also you can see how this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in certain ways in terms of fear circulating. Because if you've got reports saying dramatic, unprecedented spike in universities of anti-Semitic incidents, then you're, if you're a Jewish student and you're not aware of the way these sort of statistics are collated and reported by groups like the ADL, then you in turn will be like, wow, okay, there's loads and loads of anti-Semitism around, I should feel afraid, which is not a helpful feeling if in fact you are aware that the existence of Palestinian solidarity, the existence of Palestinians, is not a threat to Jewish existence.
Yeah, the exaggerations actually discredit the real thing.
Very much, and it makes it much, much harder to face head on. One of the other violences, and indeed with anti-Semitic consequences on the insistence of the conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, is that if it is insisted that all Jewish people do, in fact, support the Zionist project, and the Zionist project is a genocidal one, then if all Jewish people are then read as in support of a genocidal project and a project of ethnic cleansing, then of course you are going to see a rise in anti-Semitism, which is why it's all the more important as Jews and comrades of Jews to resist that conflation for the sake of Jewish safety.
I'm speaking with The Intercept columnist Natasha Leonard. What about the role of Title VI? What is it and how does it apply in these cases?
Title VI is part of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination based on race, color, ethnicity, national origin. Title VI investigations are launched following complaints if an educational institution, from schooling up until higher education, is found to be in violation of Title VI, it risks losing federal financial assistance. So Title VI is a way of monitoring and responding to issues of systematic and institutional racism in educational spaces. Right now, we're seeing it weaponized, and again, ironically, by the very people that decry frameworks around anti-racism being active on campuses. But it's being deployed by individuals and groups to report educational and particularly university institutions for anti-Semitism on campuses, and then leading to investigations. And this, we've seen 83 of these investigations opened since October 7th, and many of them around the question of anti-Semitism, also Islamophobia. But, you know, we are seeing a lot of complaints around anti-Semitism. Now, what I think is worth noting is that just a single man called Zachary Marshall, who is the editor of the right-wing website Campus Reform, profoundly anti-DEI. This has been his shtick for a while. He is responsible for 10 complaints that led to 10 of these investigations against universities, 10 of 80 since October 7th. This man is not himself a part of any of the institutions that he has launched complaints ostensibly on behalf of the Jewish students who are members of. And so anyone, you don't have to be of an institution or within an institution to be the complainant against it. Do we think necessarily that the federal Title VI investigations will be found to be valid, the ones, for example, that Marshall has launched, or will they just be closed? They are very, very thin from what we do know about them. They're not publicly available in terms of detail, but from the Campus Reform website, you can get a very strong sense of what his complaints consist in. If they do hold up, that would be an indictment of Title VI, but the threat of them and the risk to reputation alone is a major issue. One of Marshall's complaints, as reported in Campus Reform, was against Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and it seems to center on the fact that dozens of faculty members signed a pro-ceasefire letter that was in turn commended by CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is a Muslim civil rights group that's for decades now faced a lot of animus. He said, because this letter exists per se and was commended by CARE, then we've got anti-Semitism on campus. It's not just a one-man campaign, but if you've got 10 open investigations by one man, 10 out of 80, I can't help but think that these are not the kind of challenges to real rises in anti-Semitism, real anti-Semitic violences and threats that we should be attending to. And yet you have headline after headline raising the alarm in establishment news about dramatic threats to Jewish students on campus that refuse to do the very simple work of picking apart what's really going on here. So it creates more of a moral panic in turn, and once again draws attention away to where it really must be, which is not the alleged threat to Jewish students because they insist on an allegiance with Zionism and thus feel afraid, but in fact the real threat to intellectual life, which is not just a threat, it's a catastrophe. In Gaza, there is not a single university left standing on the Gaza Strip. They have all been completely obliterated by Israel's bombardments. So, you know, if we're talking about threats to robust intellectual life, then this is where our attention should be. Instead, it's on trumped up fears to students who are not, in fact, at significant risk for violence as Jews.
To be fair, shouldn't we consider how the left, campus and otherwise, has laid the foundation for this problem? The centering of safety, the treatment of offensive speech as violent, the whole no platforming stance. Hasn't this all turned around and bitten us?
Yeah, it's a good point, and it's certainly one I've thought about, especially because I'm not a free speech absolutist. I very much stood by the position that it's not a sticks and stones word can never hurt me problem. There is certainly such a thing as violent speech. It is far more capacious than what, say, for example, the First Amendment considers violent speech. And I think we should be able to vigorously protest and indeed ban certain oppressive speech from our spaces, from campuses, from our educational institutions. I've held that line for a long time. So you could say, aha, gotcha. Now that very framework is biting you in the ass because, you know, it's being used by pro-Israel groups to say that, you know, pro-Palestine activism on campus is threatening safe spaces. But, you know, I think it was always a trope that applied to certain liberal iterations, which are too common, but are a certain caricature that I don't think is fair or a fair representative of this counter-oppressive speech take that I have and others on the left have, which is to say, oh, we must privilege all feelings and any bad feeling must be avoided. And that is the meaning of safe space. To me, that would be to misframe what a useful meaning and a productive and politically productive and liberatory understanding of safe space or countering oppressive speech could look like, which is not just about, well, you feel unsafe, therefore you are. Because if that were the line, then the same surely would apply to the white student brought up in a racist town or household who is afraid in the presence of black people. We don't validate that. Why do we not validate that? Because we insist and take seriously the fact that there needs to be grounds and material histories of violence that through certain speech is reiterated and finds new iteration in its presence. And does a certain speech act, does a certain speaker in their presence and speaking on campus, therefore reiterate and reintroduce that violence anew. Now, I completely reject that a Palestinian flag or people calling for a free Palestine and demanding an end to this genocidal war, demanding an end to occupation, is a reiteration of a violence that should be therefore removed and challenged as oppressive. Do I think it is, for example, a reiteration of a violence, especially now, to invite a standing, active IDF officer to come and speak about the war on a university? I do. I bring up that example because in my university, the Hillel student group did recently invite an active, not a retired IDF lieutenant to come and speak. I was among faculty members who, in advance of the talk, wrote to express opposition. Now, in the letter that I signed, there was the claim that it shouldn't happen because it made Palestinian and Palestinian supportive students feel utterly unsafe. Now, I don't think that's actually a good reason, because they might feel utterly unsafe in the presence of an IDF soldier for good reason. But that feeling of utter unsafety does not actually give strong enough grounds for that person to not come and speak. But rather the grounds is that I don't think we should be giving a platform for an army that continues to violate international law, is actively engaged in perpetrating human rights abuses and the murder of Palestinians in both Gaza and the West Bank. Indeed, should we be inviting the active official and officer to a university when the army he represents has obliterated every single university in Gaza? I don't think so, because I do think that gives license to and legitimates violent speech in our presence that is oppressive. Is that a matter of students being unsafe? No. That's about standing against the reiteration of violent speech in our midst. So I think drawing that distinction, which I hate to say it might be helpful because nothing feels helpful now, and the only thing that would be helpful is an end to this bloody war, but it does at least maybe clarify against some of the worst right-wing reads of safe space discourse and the worst liberal iterations of it, that no, we actually shouldn't be just talking about feelings of safety. We should be talking about material realities that reproduce feelings of safety because they reproduce violent hierarchies.
That was Natasha Leonard, columnist for The Intercept and a member of the journalism faculty at the New School. You're listening to Behind the News on Jacobin Radio. My name is Doug Henwood, back after a musical break. That was some of Haydn's piano trio, Hoboken 15, No. 26, performed by the Beaux-Arts Trio. Next, a look at the global shipping industry in the wake of the giant container ship, the Dolly, crashing into the Key Bridge in Baltimore. The Dolly was leased, though not directly owned, by Maersk, the second largest container shipping company in the world. Based in Denmark, Maersk has 100,000 employees worldwide and almost 700 ships to its name. It had $51 billion in revenue and $4 billion in profits last year. You might think a giant like that could keep its ships from crashing into bridges, but alas, it can't. Here to explain the structure of the industry and how it contributed to the collision is Stefan Yang. He is a graduate student in the History of Consciousness program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's studying the political economy of shipping since World War II. Stefan Yang, did this accident in Baltimore come as a surprise to you, or was this a disaster waiting to happen?
It came as a surprise only insofar as how much the public immediately seized on it. And I guess you could say that this was because it happened in metropolitan U.S. port. The port of Baltimore is one of the busiest ports in the U.S., carries like the most vehicle traffic out of America. Maritime disasters, even ship bridge collisions are not uncommon, even by big container ships. So it's not a surprise on that front, but the attention that this is received, I think, from where the location is, that was the main surprise.
Tell me something about the accidents elsewhere. Have similar things occurred in other ports that we just don't hear about because we're provincial Americans?
So port collisions happen on occasions. One of the things that happened in the Dali disaster was that there was a pilot on board. So because of how large the vessel is and how comparatively small the port channels are, how comparatively ill-equipped infrastructure like the Francis Scott Key Bridge is to handle this size of container ships, you have, in many cases, pilots who specialize solely in getting the ship from its berth in the port to the open ocean, at which point it gets handed over to the rest of the crew. But other incidents have continued to happen. One big one of a large container ship happened in 2018, a vessel called the Maersk Honam. I bring this up because it was the largest sort of container vessel accident in recent years, and also that it was a ship owned by Maersk, which also chartered the vessel Dali. The Honam was registered under the flag of Singapore, just as the Dali was. And what happened was that the Honam caught fire in the Arabian Sea. 5 out of the crew of 25, 27 lost their lives in that accident. And there was a sort of insurance fiasco similar to what we're seeing now with the Dali.
What kind of insurance fiasco were we seeing now, and what happened then?
What is happening now is a question of who pays. And people are speculating, just because of the number of containers on board, the value of the cargo, which is still unknown at this point, because as with all container ships, it is very, very difficult to figure out exactly what is on board inside those metal boxes. And so the payout for this particular incident is going to depend on the damage done to the bridge, damage done to the ship, insurance coverage that will pay out to the families of the 6 workers who lost their lives from the bridge, damage to the Port of Baltimore, and implications for trade on eastern seaboard ports, and then, of course, the value of the cargo. And right now, the playbook is kind of standard. The owner of the ship, Grace Ocean, based in Singapore, as well as the ship management company, Synergy, also based in Singapore, claiming limited liability under some old laws. They're trying to limit the liability of their payout to the value of the ship after the crash. The ship lost about half its value in the crash, and so they're claiming that their payout responsibility will be that 50-ish percent of the ship's value. They're also declaring a principle called general average, which means that all the owners of the various bits of cargo on board will have to pay out a proportion of the value of the cargo carried on the ship. And that's going to take a while to figure out how much that is. And in that process, we'll see which cargo owners took out insurance for their commodities and which ones did not.
This can be a field day for the lawyers then.
Definitely.
They always seem to win these things. You know, as I was telling you before I pressed the record button, I did some merchant seamanship in the early 70s, and the ships I was on, container ships, early container ships, were pretty small compared to these monsters. Are these things just getting too big?
Yes, they are getting too big, and in a way that seems increasingly irrational. So the main reason why you want to have a big ship over a smaller one is that when the market is good, when the freight rates are high, such as, you know, as we saw during the pandemic, a bigger ship that is fully loaded is going to get much higher amount of freight revenue than a smaller ship. And on the other hand, when the market is bad, when freight prices are low, it's the economies of scale. It's the unit cost savings of the big ship that makes all the difference. So that when price is at a certain level on a certain route, a big ship is always going to outperform a smaller ship, all other things being equal. The interesting point here is that cost savings for ship size go on a sort of curve that is a little asymptotic, meaning that from small size to medium size, the cost savings are fabulous proportionally. But as the ship gets bigger and bigger, the marginal unit cost savings get smaller and smaller. And so you need massive size increases to recoup the same amount of cost savings that you would have otherwise done just by an extra 1,000 container capacity. Now, the capacities are jumping all the time. Estimations in the early 2000s of what is the maximum size of a container ship, the maximum number of containers that a container vessel could carry, those estimations are being broken all the time. And so too big, I think, relative to port infrastructures, relative to supply chain disruptions, is the right qualifier here.
And what about the risks? They must rise with the size too. So if you're getting diminishing gains from the increase in size, you must be getting increasing risks with size.
That's right. The increasing risks mostly involve the ability to fill the ship. So the problem that you get with a ship like the Dali, it has a capacity of a little bit less than 10,000 20-foot equivalent unit containers. That's a lot of containers. And all those containers need to be filled through really complex brokering, chartering processes that involve commodity traders, the ship owners themselves, the chartering company like Maersk, like a whole logistics operation dedicated to getting those ships filled. It is uneconomical for a container ship like the Dali to sail, let's say, half loaded. It would simply not recoup the costs of fuel on long voyages, et cetera, et cetera.
I believe you said there were a crew of 26.
On the Honam in 2018, it was around 26, I believe. On this one, 22 seafarers, all Indian nationals.
In my seafaring days, we had a crew of 39, thanks to the union. But, you know, it's a much, much smaller and less complex ship. So that's really a small crew. Is that an issue?
It is an issue because it depends what you mean by an issue.
Both safety, for one.
Yes. So the trend, you know, from the time that you've spent on container ships back in the day to now, the frontier of cost savings is manpower and wages. And part of the bigness of ships, the way these vessels are just getting larger and larger, part of the point of it is to decrease as much as possible manning costs. So they're not only more complex vessels, they're more complex vessels that are designed to be staffed by a smaller and smaller crew, because that is one frontier of cost savings that is within the control of the shipping lines. For example, shipping lines do not control the price of fuel. Shipping lines do not control the port charges that they incur when their vessels go into port for loading and unloading, but they can control wages, manning costs, and everything involving personnel. The small number of seafarers on a given ship has obvious safety implications. It's especially so because the working conditions are minimally regulated. Seafarers, on average, work 11 hours a day, 7 days a week. They live where their workplace is. They cannot leave for the duration of the voyage. And oftentimes, even when the voyage is concluded, there are visa restrictions, difficulties getting on board that mean that workers on ships are often confined to vessels. This is not good for safety.
And what about, I mean, obviously there's going to be an investigation in this, but what about maintenance on these behemoths? Is that a concern?
It is a concern to varying degrees, depending on how much the ship owner, the shipping company, decides to comply with various internationally recognized regulations. So this particular ship, the Dali, I assume that more details will come out in the investigation, but one finding so far that has been circulating is that on an inspection in Chile, the Dali was found to have unspecified issues with its propulsion systems. And the propulsion systems were obviously at play in the collision, because the engine of a big container ship like the Dali is such that when it's moving, when it's on course, the diesel engine that it operates on, you cannot simply go astern while the vessel is moving forward. You have to actually bring it to a complete stop and then go astern. And so when it's ahead, there's very little that can stop it when the propulsion systems combine with electrical failures of the kind that we saw. The details, again, are hazy because it was subsequently reported that there were other inspections on the vessel, which the Dali subsequently passed. The rigor of those inspections will vary from port authority to port authority, depending on what regulations are imposed on the ship, which changes all the time and, as I said, are often minimal.
I'm speaking with Stefan Young, a student of the political economy of shipping. That was my next question. Like, who regulates these things? How carefully are they regulated, and how carefully and how often are they inspected?
The answer depends, again, on the willingness of port authorities to regulate and also on the willingness of the flag state. So the flag state meaning the nationality that the vessel flies, the country that the vessel is registered to. International standards that exist are largely set out by the International Maritime Organization, which is a sub-agency of the United Nations. And they frequently publish guidelines and regulations for, most importantly, safety at sea, for environmental pollution and emissions, and also for seafaring wages. These are guidelines that can be followed, but it depends a lot on the buy-in of port states, and flag states, because the IMO has no sanctioning capabilities. They cannot actually enforce the regulations that they hold up. And so you have a whole spectrum of willingness to enforce depending on which port, which flag.
I imagine the flags are chosen on the basis of their friendliness to the owners.
Correct. One of the big neoliberal developments in shipping since the 70s has been the rise of flags of convenience. Flags of convenience, you know, a kind of old phenomenon where if it does not make sense business-wise or politically to fly a certain flag on a ship where, let's say, the ship owner is based, they will fly another flag instead. Since the 70s, when the imperative to cut costs became widespread and global across the shipping industry, you see this like massive rise of ships being registered to countries like Panama, Liberia, the Marshall Islands. These are flags of convenience because they offer their national flag to a ship. And under international law, the ship will then be governed by the regulations of that country. And so countries that are willing to offer their flag for a very, very modest registration fee are attractive to ship owners because they can circumvent income taxes, they can circumvent taxes on revenue, they can circumvent labor regulations, safety regulations, environmental protections, and so on. A country like Singapore, under which the Dali was registered, is what some scholars call like a quasi-flag of convenience. So it's not in this sort of race to the bottom, like no regulations at all. It offers many of the benefits of the flags of Panama, Liberia, the Marshall Islands, and so on, in terms of very, very low taxes, very, very lax regulations for labor, especially on what nationality you can recruit seafaring crews from. But they have slightly more regulations. There has to be a certain level of transparency of the ownership, for example. One problem with many ships, especially ones that are abandoned, is that the port gets in touch with the flag state and says, we need to talk to the owner to figure out what to do with the ship. The flag state has no idea how to contact the owner. The ship owner is kind of elusive, hidden behind layers of shell companies, paper companies, offices that are located in an address in a place like Panama, but don't actually exist or are not staffed by anyone. There are layers of kind of murky, tangled nationality that happen when it comes time to figure out who the ship belongs to, which, you know, is a question that arises every time there's a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, this world is very murky, isn't it? All these, like, as you say, shell companies and cross-ownership, and nobody really knows who controls what. Is that pretty much the dominant model in this business?
I believe so. You could think of each ship as being, you know, somewhat akin to like a export processing zone, where the ship has a particular kind of overlapping series of regulations based on the flag state and so on. And the incentive is to have those regulations be not necessarily all the way as low as possible, but pretty minimal.
In this case, Maersk is a big name, but they rented the ship, right? So what is Maersk's responsibility in a situation like this?
You know, legally, in terms of insurance and liability and so on, I don't know for sure, but I want to say that Maersk going to be fairly well covered because, like you were pointing out, they don't own the ship. They were not managing the ship. However, I think it's important to note that Maersk has quite deep connections to this particular vessel. The Dali was built in South Korea under Hyundai Heavy Industries, and it was part of a fleet of 7 to 8 big container ships that were designed in a very specific way to expand their capacity. So talking about big ships, not necessarily to make the ship larger according to some you know, imperative to grow the ship, but to move things around within the vessel design, to shift the bridge from aft, which is, you know, the rear of the ship, to about 1/3 of the way aft. And this allowed more containers to be stacked on it. The initial design of the Dali was 9,000 box capacity. After the redesign, it had about a 10,000 box capacity. Maersk was chartering the Dali and its sibling ships since it was under construction. Maersk was chartering the Dali at the time that it had a previous collision accident, no fatalities, coming out of the port of Antwerp. And as far as I can tell, it's been chartering the vessel ever since, meaning that if you charter a vessel, you're basically renting it in order to decide what its schedule is, where it's going to sail, which port is next, these kinds of things. The management, the personnel, crew recruitment, day-to-day operations were not done by Maersk. It was outsourced to this other company, Synergy, which I believe also has an exclusive contract to, you know, manage Maersk's operations, not for its container ships, but for its oil tanker ships. So there's a way that Maersk is there. From a liability standpoint, it might be elusive to see this massive Danish company pay up much at all. But I would say that as, you know, the second biggest container shipper in the world, it's a big player in this case. And I think its role has been under-discussed.
More work for the lawyers then. And finally, the bridge. I saw a list the other day of 10 bridges across the U.S. that are more or less equally vulnerable. Are we slack on just how carefully these bridges are insulated against these sorts of disasters?
I'm not a bridge expert at all, but there does seem to be a kind of propensity for U.S. bridges in particular to be vulnerable to ship collisions. I was reading a 1983 report by a committee on ship bridge collisions that was commissioned by the U.S. National Research Council. And this committee was formed because in the years between 1963 and 1983, there was like a huge uptick in ship bridge collisions worldwide, and half of them were happening in the U.S. One of them was an incident involving, you know, the last time that the Francis Scott Key Bridge was collided into by a ship. That was a much smaller vessel that collided into one of the main piers of the bridge, but only damaged the concrete collar on the piling. I can't say for sure, you know, not being a bridge historian, but it does seem to me like bridges in the U.S. are vulnerable. In any case, infrastructure in this country does not seem to me to be particularly well maintained, publicly financed, and so on. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, yes, to say the least. I'm Stefan Young, a graduate student at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who is studying the political economy of shipping since World War II. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. The ship that took down the Francis Scott Key Bridge was named after Salvador Dali. In honor of the culprit's name, let's go out with this, a whimsical old favorite, Salvador Dali's Garden Party, a 1989 song from the Television Personalities. Till next week, bye.
And Dali loved tremendously money and gold.